The Joyride.
OFM, the sound of your life. This is The Joyride and our series on Adulting 101. How to tackle the real world. How to survive in the madness that is going on at the moment. So privileged to have Jen Thorpe with us again for episode number 2. Jen, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Nico. Nice to be here.
Your book has really inspired me over the last couple of weeks. I've had a lot of free time, and I've actually gone into some depth in the book, trying to see where I can better my life skills as an adult for those things that we never got taught at school and at varsity. For those people that haven't heard our first episode and are tuning in for the first time, can you maybe just give us a rough overview of what you've tried to achieve with the book and what people can expect?
Sure. So Adulting 101 is really a survival guide for grown-ups of all ages. It covers things like taking care of yourself with your health, taking care of your relationships. It talks about sex and baby making and how we can do that safely and with consent. There's also practical tips like how to find a place to live, you know, whether you should rent or to buy and what you should know before you do either of those. And chapter 7 is about your work-life balance. And then there's also tips on managing your money, getting to know your government, and how to deal with crises like misinformation, fake news, climate change, and crime. Unfortunately, I didn't include how to deal with World War III, which I think we're all busy worrying about right now. But I think the crises tips will help you out nonetheless.
That is such a wonderful selection of thoughts that can keep us not worried, but make us do a little bit of introspection a little bit. In the first episode, we spoke mainly about how to look after yourself from a sleep perspective and just to be a little bit better, you know, physically. Today, we're also going to be looking at the mental side of things. And one thing that I picked up in this section of the book is that you mentioned that more than 264 million people in the world suffer from depression, and sometimes it's a lonely illness, it's a lonely struggle, but I think a lot of people need to realize that you are not alone, and there are many people that are going through this anxiety, depression, what they also call burnout in your book. I mean, I think one thing we need to clarify today as well is what's the difference between burnout and depression, and then also like trauma. I think that people don't deal with trauma efficiently, if I can put it that way. The first thing you talk about when it comes to mental health is the aspect of anxiety. How do you think we lack as grown-ups today dealing with our mental health?
Well, I think one of the things is that it's really hard to talk about. I mean, if you are feeling depressed or anxious, you don't really have the energy to go out and talk to people about it. So it is difficult to seek help. So just to keep that in mind, that if you've been dealing with these things and you haven't reached out, you know, don't feel worse about that fact. All of us suffer from anxiety, depression, struggles with our energy at some point. One of the useful ideas that I cover in the book is the difference between depression and burnout that you mentioned, which is I got from a book by Judy Klippen, where she says depression is being tired of life and burnout is being tired from life. And so it's really hard sometimes for us to tell the difference between depression, anxiety, and burnout, because the world is pretty chaotic and feeling complex emotions in response to the chaos is completely normal. But anxiety becomes a serious problem when it's chronic. So when you start to have significant worry and fear that doesn't go away or gets worse over time, which then in turn infects those things that we talked about last week. It affects the way that we sleep. It affects the way that we breathe. We don't breathe calmly when we're anxious, and consequently we get more anxious. And there's also physical things like worry, panic, and fear, those feelings of rapid or irregular heartbeat. And anxiety disorders are much more common in women than in men across the world. So yesterday was International Women's Day. If you think about many of the challenges that women have to deal with on top of the challenges that everybody has to deal with, it's normal to feel anxious or stressed about things. But sometimes we say, oh, I'm so stressed. And what we mean is something different from stress. We mean something more serious. And I think it's important for us to reflect on how we're using the word and with what we mean by it.
And I think that's important for what I can only describe as a diagnosis. You know, sometimes we don't know what we don't know. And then we try and find things on Google, etc. And then we don't get the correct help that we do need in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, Google is definitely helpful because the internet is helpful in general because it allows us to recognize that we're not alone. But sometimes we can get really strange diagnoses. You can find almost anything on Google and you can, you can convince yourself that you're suffering from anything, but you can also find useful information about what you are suffering from and where to get help. So I've covered a lot of extra resources on how to seek help if you're feeling depressed. And they're at the back of the book. I'm just trying to flick through so that I can mention some of them. So there's CIPLA has a 24-hour mental health helpline, which is 0800-456-789. You can also SMS them on 31393. And then there's also the South African Depression and Anxiety Group, which you can find out more about by Googling them. They're www.sadag.org. Or you can call them on their Johannesburg landline number, which is 011-234-4837. So an important thing I want to say is really, if you are struggling, don't try to, you know, push through or muscle through. I think that what leads to burnout, you can get help and you deserve help. Mental health is health, just like anything else. You can get mentally sick the way, same way you get physically sick. It's not a failing on your part if you're dealing with some difficult feelings.
One thing that I like in this section of the book that you talk about, you say start with what you can control. Yeah. What is your angle on this statement?
Well, I read a really useful book by Gabor Maté, which says that there's three main things that commonly cause us to feel stressed, and that's uncertainty, a lack of information, and a loss of control. So if you think about surviving the pandemic, for example, all of us have had to deal with uncertainty, a lack of information, and a loss of control over the last 2 years. So it's absolutely normal that we're feeling terrible. So what you can start with is what you can control. So that's things we talked about last week, like sleeping, making sure you're drinking enough water, because if you haven't drunk enough water, getting a headache, feeling tired, feeling stressed are completely normal. Trying to get some sleep, trying to take a deep breath, that helps us to moderate our physiological response to the outside stresses in the world. It's not going to take them away, but it might make us a little bit more resilient.
Especially for us as guys, you know, sometimes we struggle mm-hmm. to ask for help. And especially when it comes to mental health issues, getting professional help, I think, is one of the most important things. And sometimes we've got these attitudes of, nah, I've got to be strong. I've got to sort it out myself. This is my problem. Yeah. How important is it to actually seek out professional help when you are struggling with any of these problems?
Look, I'm somebody who's visited psychologists and therapists myself. I think it is a hugely valuable thing because a lot of time our responses to outside stresses become habitual. So we learn how to feel stressed, and when something terrible happens, we go back into that default feeling. With men, masculinity and norms around what it means to be a man are hugely impactful on health-seeking behaviors. We know that men don't go to get tested for COVID, for example. They don't seek out mental health. It's really important to ask for help. It's a sign of strength, not a sign of weakness, to admit that you need help. You know, it's really, really difficult for many people to ask for help. I don't find it easy myself. And there aren't, unfortunately, enough free mental health services for everybody who needs them. So there's not like a free therapist for every neighborhood, which would be the ideal. But there are a number of NGOs who can be there for you when you need to seek out help and at an affordable price. And there's some that I've included in the extra resources chapter. I might publish a little blog about this later so that people can access those more easily. But really, it's important not to try and muscle through. You can talk to a friend if you can't afford a therapist or you don't have one in your area. Phone someone that you trust and just saying I'm struggling is enough to make you feel a little bit lighter.
And I think especially in the times that we are living in, I read an interesting meme this morning. The poor millennials suffered through two economic breakdowns, Y2K, pandemic, and now possibly World War III. So we've got a lot to deal with, and don't do it alone. I think that's the most important thing.
Totally.
Next up on our list is we talk a little bit about physical well-being. And I think there's a time in your life when you're so busy that even if you don't get time to exercise as a young person, you kind of burn the fat on the go. And as you get older, as you pass 35, doesn't matter what you do, the laziness kicks in. You only have so much spare time. But physical well-being is such an important part because it all plays into each other. If you don't feel well physically, it could play a part in your mental health. It could play a part in your stress levels, et cetera, et cetera.
Absolutely. So one of the things, just to touch on what we discussed last week, is that if you're very tired, you're not going to want to exercise. So getting some sleep is a first step. But really doing just a little bit of exercise. So I have a 10-minute yoga practice that I do on YouTube whenever I've, you know, when I'm feeling like I can't get something in the day. It just stretches your head, neck and shoulders. And that already helps you to feel better and a little bit more motivated to do more. But we actually need to do quite a bit more than 10 minutes a day. We need to do around an hour and a half of exercise a week, you know, up to 2.5 hours. It depends on how hard you're exercising. But all of these little bits of exercise, you know, like going out for your lunch break and walking to the place you're going rather than driving, if that's an option, is exercise. It's beneficial. You know, standing up at your desk and making sure that you don't sit for too long is exercise. So it doesn't have to be torturous, but finding something that you enjoy doing is the first way to developing a really healthy lifestyle around exercise and not making it like that compulsory PE that we had to do in school.
Jump up and down, get the blood flowing. I think that's the that's where you start. What I also liked about this section is there's one bit that you especially focus on, talking about medical aid and how important it is. And as a young person, sometimes you're like, nah, I don't need it. Or maybe I can't afford it and I'll just let it hang there. And then one day you wake up and then you actually do need it. You go through different reasons and different options in medical aid. Can you expand a little bit more on your view with regards to medical aids?
Sure. So most people in South Africa don't have medical aid. I think it's around 17% of people do. So that's really a small population. And it's difficult to know the reasons why. One of them might be that it's quite expensive. And the other is that many people don't use private healthcare as their first port of call when it comes to healthcare. They go to a public facility. So if you're going to get public healthcare, there's really not much reason to have a very expensive medical aid practice. But there's many types. So if you decide that you would like to get medical aid, the cheapest option is really to start with what's called a hospital plan, which covers you for emergencies. If you have to go to a hospital, then that's what you can get. And then there's most of them. The great thing about medical aid in South Africa is that the rates have to be the same for every person on the same plan. So they can't charge you more because you're unhealthy than if you were a healthy person, which is wonderful. But there's also things that get more expensive the more benefits you get. So if you're getting a medical aid where you can go to the chiropractor and the homeopath and physio and all of those lovely things, it's going to cost you more than one that just covers your basic day-to-day costs. So there are really many plans, and the thing is, it's hard to work out which one is the right one, and it's really hard to compare. But there's two things that you can do. The one is reach out to a broker who understands this and can advise you. And the other is to get comparative quotes using an online site like, for example, the HIPPO, where they compare many plans, give you the cost, and you can decide based on that.
There's a guy that you mentioned. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing his name right. Michael Pollins? Is that correct?
Michael Pollan,
Pollan, all right. And he wrote a book called Unhappy Meals. And I think this is something that a lot of people struggle with. The number one thing that we fight about in our house every day is, what are we eating tonight? And then you also mentioned something in the book. You say, does anyone agree really what is good for me to eat? Can you expand a little bit about what Michael's philosophy is about this and what really is good for us and not good for us to eat?
He's a fantastic journalist and nonfiction author. So if people listening haven't checked him out, I highly recommend looking into his work. But one of the things he says in that particular essay is that we should eat food, so not too much, and mostly plants.
I love that line. I actually wrote it down. Like,
it's so sensible. So I'm not going to tell you, eat this much of food. But what he says is, don't eat too much that you feel ill. So he mentions the people in Okinawa and Japan who say, eat until you're 80% full. I think many of us eat till we're way fuller than that. I'm thinking of myself as well.
Midnight snacks included.
Exactly, and snacking on the go. So sometimes you don't even notice how much you're eating. The other thing is around what food is. So in his essay, he says, food is not stuff that has like a whole lot of artificial ingredients. If you don't recognize the ingredients on the back of something that you're buying, it's probably not a good idea to eat it. And he uses a simple sort of heuristic to help you decide. He says, eat food that your grandmother would recognize as food. So eat whole foods, vegetables. If you're a meat eater, eat meats and fish that looks like meat and fish. Don't eat something that's like been heavily processed with 100 different additives and salts and spices, because most of the time it's not good for you. It's much healthier to eat whole foods that your body can digest. And then he says mostly plants. It's because plants provide us with a huge range of nutritional value, as well as microbes, which we're starting to understand are more and more important for our health and mental well-being. So it's quite a nice, simple thing to keep in your mind when you go to the shop. Eat food, not too much, mostly plants.
And you also mentioned that the gut and the mind are connected, and it needs, we need what, basically what you feed your body feeds your mind, which is kind of a given, but we need to be very cautious what we put in our stomachs, because it has an influence on our mental well-being as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's incredible. So the research around this is just starting to get more and more interesting. I highly recommend people look into it. But what they've shown is that a lot of our feel-good hormone, which is our serotonin, is actually made in our gut. The majority of it comes from our stomach. So that's why when you eat something that you, that makes you feel good, like a nourishing meal, you actually feel better afterwards. Whereas when you eat like a junk food, you feel short-term better because you've satisfied a craving, but you often feel a bit low afterwards because it has low nutritional value. And the gut is amazing. So the way our stomach microbes work is that they're sort of like pets. The ones you feed grow, and the ones you don't feed die. So if you eat a lot of cheese like I do, you've got a lot of cheese microbes in your stomach saying, feed me cheese, Jen, feed me cheese. If you don't, if you slowly start lowering the amount of that unhealthy food that you're eating, those microbes slowly die off. So you'll have less and less cravings for that food. So we can control it in a slow, phased in way. But it helps you to not feel so guilty for wanting to eat ice cream all the time. But it's because the little creatures in your stomach want you to eat it.
There we go. Listen to your stomach.
My little one is just waking up on my tummy here. I can hear him whimpering.
He's hungry. Jen, on that note,
he's hungry.
I'm gonna let you go. Thank you so much for chatting to us today. Next week, we'll tackle some more great topics. Love having this conversation. And I hope that we all can be better adults going forward.
Thanks, Nico. Have a lovely week.
The Joyride with Nico, Nikki, Aaron, and JB. On Powerhead Bed, proudly made possible by Arinel Pharmacy Group. Family values. Values for the whole family.